The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what it feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boosts and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, this is Dre, and welcome back to Pod Save the People. I'm excited that Britt, Clint, and Sam are back for the news in 2018. We also are joined today by Congressman Crowley, who represents New York City and who is the chair of the Democratic Caucus.
It has, you know, real-life consequences. You know, when the president tweets out that he thinks that people should have work requirements before they be eligible for Medicaid, you know, I question myself, does the president work enough to be eligible for the benefits that he receives at this point?
Last week I talked about having a plan, and having a plan is about setting goals, about mapping out how you can reach those goals, and ultimately about putting yourself in a position so that you're more likely to be where you need to be when the magic happens, when luck hits, when opportunities arise, because you've already thought about where you're headed. But today I want to talk about intention. And intention is about saying, why am I doing what I'm doing? What I found over the past 3 years is that a lot of people who think that they're doing really altruistic and morally courageous work, but they've never asked themselves, like, why did I go in the street? Why did I stand for that issue? Why was I silent when I thought that I would have spoken up about that thing? Why do I care about these issues? And the reason that you examine your intentions is to make sure that you're operating from a place of purpose. And when you operate from a place of purpose, you have the strength and courage to do the hard work. When you don't know why you do what you do, what you do is you find yourself standing on shaky ground. You can be moved quickly. You're not really committed. You can be swayed. It's like being in quicksand. But when you know why you're doing what you're doing, it's like being on a solid rock. Let's do this. In his news with me, Clint Smith III, our resident academic, Samuel Sinyangwe, our resident data scientist, and Brittany Pecknett, former member of the Ferguson Commission, President Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing, and current leader in education reform.
Hey, everyone. It's the news. This is Brittany Pecknett at Miss Pac Getty on all social media.
And this is Sam Sinyangwe at Sam Sway on Twitter.
What's going on, y'all? This is Clint Smith at Clint Smith III.
This is DeRay at DeRay, D-R-A-Y, on Twitter.
Well, I'm coming to you live after having listened to the Finesse remix, not one, not two, but like 10 times in a row in the last hour.
2011 times.
Yeah, like, it's so great. 2018 times. Like, why not? Like, 2018 times, 4/2018, Bruno Mars, the most perfect Cardi B on a Living Color set, like New Jack Swing all day. It just makes me so happy.
Well, Cardi's verse was what, like 16 bars? She had her 16 bars.
Yeah. And then she got some good ad-libs in the end.
She like, did. That one.
Is there some significance to 16 bars? I feel like I should know that. Is that like a...
That's basically like what a rap, how long a rap feature usually is.
Typically.
16 bars.
Okay.
If it's not 16, don't get mad at me. I don't know. I got to check Genius. But as soon as it came on, I like knew this was a banger. I was just like, oh,
It's perfect.
I could just tell.
It was New Jack Swing. And if you don't know what New Jack Swing is, you should definitely go and look it up. There's a great series on Twitter from a user who uses the hashtag Music Sermon. She did like a whole thread on the origins of New Jack Swing.
Music Sermon.
Music Sermon. I promise you it's like my favorite thing that I read each week.
Never?
Music Sermon.
It's one person
it's so
does
good.
It?
One person. Her name is Naima on Twitter. But
At Naima.
Yes. But she uses the hashtag Music Sermon, and she groups all of these. She threads these like great musicology kind of lessons, and she puts them in a moment. But the New Jack Swing one is really good. There are videos and artists and the whole nine. It's great. And you should also watch New Jack City, where you can hear the music and understand the culture that surrounded the musical movement that influenced Bruno Mars to create Finesse.
It's been playing on repeat in our house.
And we also cannot talk about all of these folks of color without being very clear and reminding ourselves as we continue in this week that people of color from all over the world have come here to America for many different reasons and continue to be a part of what actually makes America great. So no matter what an orange man in a White House has to say, these countries are not crap holes, for those of you listening with your children. And I am, of course, deeply disappointed in the fact that this kind of rhetoric continues to come out of this administration. I'm, of course, not surprised, as I'm sure none of you are. I'm also not quick to jump to trying to convince him of all people or the folks in his administration that Haitians and Africans and people from all over the world who are not white are somehow worthy, right? That like we need to list off some kind of great achievement coming from each of these countries in order for him to be convinced that we're worthy. The system of white supremacy has never buckled at the idea that people of color are intelligent and successful and smart and beautiful and enough. We are enough simply because of our humanity. And so I think it's really important to defend people and to help people be reminded of one another's humanity. But I'm not in this to convince Donald Trump or anybody else who won't agree, no matter what we say, that we're good enough and smart enough when I already know we are.
Yeah, and I think to that point, Brittany, it's part of the way that I'm thinking about this is twofold, right? So in part, I think you are exactly right in that we should not have to share stories of exceptional immigrants or like exceptional immigrant narratives in order to legitimate this place of immigrants here. Like we shouldn't have to hear stories of, you know, Haitian folks rescuing puppies from burning buildings and starting multimillion dollar businesses in order to convince ourselves that Haitians deserve to be here. And then secondly, part of the reason we can't be thinking about the phenomena of immigration to the United States from places like Haiti, El Salvador, Nicaragua, West Africa, East Africa, without accounting for the role of U.S. foreign policy that has shaped the contemporary political and economic landscape of those countries. And we've talked about this a little bit before in context of DACA, but like real folks, you can't have an honest conversation about why Haiti looks the way that it does without accounting for the like centuries of political exploitation and isolation that took place after the Haitian Revolution in 1804 because folks were mad.
Exploitation.
Right. That folks were mad. Like the entire Western Hemisphere cut Haiti off because they were upset that a black republic existed. Right. And the same with El Salvador. You can't have a real conversation about El Salvador without also taking into account the role that the U.S. government directly played in funding a civil war that fundamentally destabilized that country and created a refugee scenario, right? So we have to always be considering the full scope and the totality of these issues and just at the end of the day, like really come back to our empathy, right? Like what would we do for our own kids, for our own families if we found ourselves in situations that were often saturated with a violence and a poverty and a set of difficult political circumstances that another country played a huge role in creating in the first place. So we always have to take the sort of long historical arc into perspective when thinking about these things.
It's so easy for people to choose not to engage with this idea that we are part, that our security and stability is one of the reasons why other countries are destabilized. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that is, I think you make that point extra, and you made it before with DACA. And I'd love to figure out like how we can have that be one of the talking points at the national level too, because it's so real that like part of our comfort, it rests on the back, you know, as much as we talk about the ills of colonialism and how it's destroyed countries, including this one, for so many people, it's like we've actually replicated that same model and we benefit from, like we right. as like a stable society in some ways benefit from the destabilization of other societies. So thank you, Clint. I'm always learning too.
So this podcast comes out on Tuesday, and so that's a day after Martin Luther King Jr. National Holiday. And as many folks are coming to understand, I think that we are becoming increasingly clear in our sort of popular national discourse around the fact that Martin Luther King is not simply the rhetorical teddy bear that we have sort of rendered him into a caricature of. And, you know, I think the most often quoted part of Dr. King and his legacy is the I Have a Dream speech, and a very specific part of the I Have a Dream speech that is often decontextualized in a way that is meant to propagate this narrative of colorblindness and sort of integration without any sort of reconciliation or without any sort of reparations. And that is simply not the case, right? That is not accounting for, one, that is taking Dr. King's words out of context. Also, it is not accounting for the sort of larger political project that Dr. King engaged in. So, you know, first, it's important to consider the fact that, you know, Dr. King, while he is sort of universally celebrated now, we may have talked about this before, but he's universally celebrated now. But if you go back and look at the Gallup polls in 1966, nearly two-thirds of Americans didn't approve of him or what he was doing. They thought it was too radical. They thought he was asking for too much. They didn't like his tactics. They didn't like the way that he was thinking about and approaching civil rights. They didn't like the sort of increasingly radical vision that he was espousing about what a more equitable world should look like. But people don't want to reckon with that part of who Dr. King is in the way that we think about who he is now. And so we sort of erase that part and we make him into a caricature again of who he actually was. And the danger of that is that when you make a caricature of someone like Dr. King, you make a caricature of an entire movement, right? And so that's when people fail to consider the fact that the civil rights movement was not just this, you know, Bryan Stevenson always talks about it as if it were this 3-day festival, right? He says on day one, Rosa sat down on a bus. Day two, Martin had a dream. Day three, Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks were passing out cotton candy. Everybody could vote. We sang Kumbaya and it was cool. And it's funny, but like that is the way that many people think about what the civil rights movement was. And that is does such a disservice to like the decades long struggle that the civil rights movement actually was and doesn't wrestle with the very difficult nature and full context of how social change actually happens. And when you do that, when you make a caricature of an entire movement, then when Colin Kaepernick takes a knee or Black Lives Matter walks across a bridge, people are like, Black Lives Matter would, you know, or Dr. King would never walk across a bridge. He would never let people do that. That's ridiculous. He would never allow such a thing to happen. And you're like, Selma came out like just 2 years ago. Like, what are you talking about? You need to watch that movie. And I just want to point out, Brandon Terry, who's a professor at Harvard, has a great essay that came out in the Boston Review that's sort of rethinking Dr. King and his legacy. And part of what he's focusing on is a speech he gave in 1968 called Beyond Vietnam. And if you haven't read it, you should absolutely read it. We're going to put it in the show notes and on the website. But I just want to read an excerpt of it. Perhaps a more tragic recognition of reality took place when it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and die in extraordinarily high proportions relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by our society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia or East Harlem. And he goes on, I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I cannot be silent. And so the last thing I'll say about this is that I think that we can take what Dr. King is thinking about in Beyond Vietnam and think about how applicable it is today, and the fact that King, especially at the end of his life, was coming to understand the fact that we could not understand and make sense of the social and racial inequality domestically here in the United States without accounting for the role that U.S. foreign policy plays in creating a sort of like global destabilization of inequality across the globe, right? And whether it be in Southeast Asia or different parts of the global South. And I think that that's something that we can think about right now, right? As we kind of mentioned at the beginning of the show, we can't really have a conversation about what the contemporary landscape of inequality and race and racism looks like in this country without thinking about the way that the forces of our immigration system are shaped by U.S. foreign policy today.
Clint, I'm so thankful you brought this up. I just did a video with Mike that we released this weekend talking about exactly this, about how much we sanitize Dr. King and how really we let ourselves off the hook when we do so. Because if we forced ourselves to reckon not only with his legacy, but with the philosophies and the work and the movement that was happening all around him, we would have to reckon with ourselves very differently. We'd have to ask ourselves if we were the white moderates he was talking to in the letter from a Birmingham jail, if we would have been following along in opposition because our families and friends told us that being racist was the popular thing and we just didn't want to make anybody uncomfortable at the dinner table. We would have had to ask ourselves if we were willing to sacrifice everything as he and so many of his contemporaries were. I also think that what you brought up about Beyond Vietnam in particular and his work around that is important when we reckon with the philosophy of nonviolence. Dr. King was a pacifist for very specific reasons. And I think so many people align being nonviolent with being a coward, and they're just not synonymous whatsoever. The purpose of nonviolence, especially as it was used in the mid-century civil rights movement, was not about somehow showing the system of white supremacy or individual white supremacists that Black people or oppressed people or poor people were good enough or that we had nice enough clothes to wear and therefore you should like us, you should want to be our neighbors, or that we eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches just like you, so why not sit down next to us at the Woolworths counter? The point was not to justify our humanity by being nonviolent. Nonviolence as a principle is powerful in that it exposes just how evil oppression is. So if you imagine the image of Bull Connor standing up against a peaceful John Lewis, that helped expose something to people who thought that Black folks and oppressed people were just complaining for no reason. When you think about water hoses and attack dogs being used against peaceful children, that sends a particular message, and that principle of nonviolence is central there. Similarly, as Dr. King has already said, when you think about the entire U.S. government and the way it assaulted the people of Vietnam, we cannot extend the principle of nonviolence and the principle of peaceful direct action only domestically. And so I think that's a really important point. And, you know, like I said, nonviolence is not cowardice. It's also not fear of confrontation, right? We're talking about nonviolent direct action. As you already said, people already thought Dr. King was way too radical. Quite frankly, they spoke about Dr. King and his contemporaries in a lot of the same ways they speak about us right now, that we're race baiters, that we talk about race too much, that we were engaged in peaceful direct action, but it made people uncomfortable or it was inconvenient, and therefore we should go home and just negotiate. While you're reading Beyond Vietnam, you should also pick up a letter from a Birmingham jail and understand why that approach, that philosophy, was antithetical to what Dr. King stood for, what we all stand for. And so I'm hopeful that both as you engaged in your MLK holiday this weekend and as you move forward in your activism and thoughtfulness throughout the year, that you will take these things to heart.
So two things about this piece that were interesting to me. The first was one of the justifications for nonviolent direct action was this issue of participation and mass participation being so essential to being able to actually confront, disrupt, and dismantle these oppressive systems and structures. And so the theory being that nonviolent direct action was something that everybody could participate in. It wasn't limited to folks who were, you know, lawyers or, you know, highly, you know, particularly skilled as policy advocates or what have you. It wasn't limited to a particular group of people, a particular race or gender. It was something that people at writ large could participate in, could come out into the streets, could put their bodies on the line in unison. Folks who had you know, various different age groups, like all of that, and being part of thinking in advance, what does it mean to have a mass movement? What does it mean to sustain that movement? What does it mean to have opportunities and pathways for as many people as possible to be involved in creating change? And I think that that ethos is just as important today as it was in the civil rights movement. And I think the second piece was this focus on, in addition to dismantling Jim Crow laws and barriers to political participation, King's focus on economic inequality and poverty as well, and how so much work has yet to be done to achieve some of the basic programs that King was advocating for, whether it's universal basic income, which is something that we're having conversations about right now in many cities and states. I know Stockton under Mayor Tubbs became the first city to actually begin implementing a universal basic income program, as well as programs like the Federal Jobs Guarantee, which there have been a number of articles and think pieces that have come out on that, really recognizing that without resources, having political rights does not necessarily translate into having the ability to exercise those rights to fully participate in and enjoy citizenship. And so we have to have the economic piece as well as the sort of removal of explicit racist barriers to participation. So those are the two things that really struck me. And you know, I think it is a testament that MLK's writings continue to be so powerful, so influential, and so prescient when we think about the struggles and the challenges that we're going through today, many of which are, you know, really exactly the same, just a new iteration with, you know, the descendants of the same people that were at the table last time.
All of this makes me think, too, of the question of, can we build a critical mass? Like, can we, when we think about the importance of mass action, when we think about nonviolence as a strategy that forces the system to respond, and as the article talks about, King thinks of nonviolence as nonviolent direct action is something that is always supplemented by procedural justice, that is always supplemented by other forms of action. So the courts need to work, people need to vote, the elections matter. All of those work in concert. It's not as if sit-ins are the only part of the strategy, just as they weren't the only part of the strategy back then. I'm interested, though, in like how technology will either help us or hurt us in the work of building sort of a mass movement or building mass action, that I think in some ways we have overcome the awareness battle in a really quick and easy fashion relative to the past. I think about a conversation with King's first barber in Montgomery when he first moved to town. And he talked about, he was like, I remember when King became like the person that you all think of today. He was like, we had a public meeting. There weren't a lot of, like, there was no way for you to sort of meet somebody like that unless you went and heard them talk in public. And he was like, I heard him talk. We all heard him talk. And you could just tell he had a gift. But you think about what it meant that the only way that you could be in proximity to people's ideas was like to physically be in their presence. And like, we're just in a different time so that it does allow ideas to spread quicker. I do think, though, that something might be lost in sort of the vibrancy or the call to action when the physical proximity just isn't there in that way. Can we build something using technology that mimics that, that mobilizes people too? I'm hopeful. I think that we're on the cusp. I think that the protests in Ferguson are like probably the best example of technology and not sort of one person creating space that allow other people to create space. But that's what I think of when I think about this moment now, is that we saw both the beauty and the limits of the civil rights movement. We saw the transformative power of leadership like King and its limits. What will our lessons be in this moment is what I think of when I read this piece by Brandon.
And one last thing I'll say is I think many of us, you know, either in high school or college or on our own time have read many of Dr. King's pieces of writing and speeches, but would really encourage folks to listen to a lot of his speeches. I think it creates an entirely different sort of sensory experience. I listened to Beyond Vietnam just before we came in to record, and I had read the speech several times, but this is the first time that I had listened to it. And to, as DeRay was alluding to, like, it, I was not physically there when he was giving the speech, obviously, but I felt a sort of intimacy to his words in a way that I had not before, because I was listening to him. I could hear the pauses. I could hear the inflections. And it's, you know, people are busy, and it's also sometimes easier. You know, a lot of King's speeches were very long, and I think if you just go on YouTube and listen to some of this stuff in the background while you're making dinner or doing laundry, it creates a really worthwhile experience.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Don't go anywhere. There's more to come.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
Save big now during Menards Super Savings Sale. Brighten your home with a 3-panel LED light bulb, now just $1.99. Stay warm with a hardwood firewood bundle, only $3.99. Stock up with Clorox All-Purpose Cleaner, just $2.99. A 16-pack of Zest bar soap is only $7.99. Hurry, these great deals won't last long. Sign up for Menards emails to get the weekly flyer plus exclusive daily flash sales right to your inbox.
Save big money at Menards.
So my piece of news is an initiative, a ballot initiative in Washington State, which local activists, a large coalition of local activists in Washington State called De-Escalate Washington, have submitted more than 350,000 signatures to the Secretary of State's office there in Washington that would force the legislature there to consider a measure that would change the state's deadly force law with regard to police. So in Washington State, it is the only state that has a requirement that prosecutors show that police acted intentionally with malice in order to be able to prosecute that officer and charge them criminally for using deadly force. And so, you know, we've talked about police violence many times in the past and some of the statistics about how hard it is to charge for an officer to ultimately end up being charged and how rare it is for an officer to be charged following a police shooting. It was about 1% of officers were charged for killing somebody last year of over 1,100 people who were killed. And in Washington State, it is actually the hardest of any other state because of that law. And so the initiative would change that standard, removing that malice requirement, as well as doing a number of other great things like requiring de-escalation training, requiring training on training police officers on how to interact with folks who have mental illness, as well as a number of other things, implicit bias, requiring officers to intervene and provide first aid in a situation where somebody is injured or shot. And so all of those things have to be considered now because they've collected enough signatures. They will have to be considered by the state legislature. If the state legislature does not end up passing this, then it goes to the ballot in November where the voters will end up deciding on this. And so I bring this piece of news because, you know, this is an example. You know, we talked about the ballot initiative in Florida. This is going on in Washington State. And it's an example of the people really coming together and organizing in the majority of states that allow ballot initiatives to put measures directly on the ballot or to force the legislature to consider them to change some of these fundamentally broken and unjust aspects of the system to ensure that, one, that we're addressing issues like police violence and mass incarceration, and that we are doing things that politically have not been done that should have been done for quite some time.
I'm fascinated by ballot initiatives and the power that they give people all across the country to to like make change without having to just lobby legislators for it, like to be able to put things directly before voters. Not every state in the country actually has that mechanism in place. So it'll be interesting to see how it's used. We know we've all seen California used it for a host of things. It is beautiful to see the organizers in Washington use it. And I'll be looking forward to states all across the country. It'd be fascinating to think about criminal justice reform being done through ballot initiative as opposed to having to wait for legislators to actually get the moral footing and to finally get the courage to actually do what is right. But just let the people do it.
Just let the people do it. That should be on bumper stickers, T-shirts, banners.
Just let the people. That's what we'll call this episode. Just let the people do it.
Just let the people do it.
Just let the people do it.
So I want to talk about healthcare, but I want to talk about the aspect of healthcare that often gets erased, and it's healthcare for young people, for children. We often don't talk about it because those folks who are under 18 cannot show up at the ballot box and engage in their citizenry in the same way that those of us who are older than 18 do. So it's important that we shine a light whenever we get a chance. The Children's Health Insurance Program, also known as CHIP, technically had its funding expire at the end of September 2016. Through a series of small fixes, Congress has temporarily been able to push off the most damaging effects of this expiring. And the hope has been that Congress would actually renew funding for CHIP before the worst happened. But as we speak, we are at risk of CHIP running out of funding any single day now. And what that means for states is that they will either be forced to make the decision to cut off enrollment, which means no new children could be a part of CHIP, or to actually drop children who are already enrolled in CHIP and receive their health care that way. I think it goes without saying the kind of devastating effect this would have on families all across the country. Families who leverage CHIP every single day for preventative care, to make sure that their children have all their shots and immunizations before they go to school, to make sure that children have access to primary care physicians so that they can actually engage in preventative health care. Hopefully, it also goes without saying that there are families with children who have much more catastrophic healthcare concerns, chronic illnesses, things that have cost prohibitive treatments that they would not be able to receive without the assistance of CHIP. Here's the other really important thing. The Congressional Budget Office a few days ago came out with a wild fact about the cost of CHIP over the next 10 years. That not only would it be free to operate CHIP over the next 10 years, it would actually save the government $6 billion. So essentially, it would save us money to help children. At the end of the day, if kids are not well, they cannot succeed. This is Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Kids need to be feeling well, doing well, thinking right, and feeling healthy in order to be successful in school, successful in social environments, et cetera, et cetera. All of the proof is there that CHIP has closed the gap of uninsured, has increased access to healthcare both in the medical field and in the dental field, and has helped children lead stronger, healthier, happier lives. So Congress clearly needs to get it together, and we can't afford to keep having conversations about healthcare without thinking about the youngest among us.
And your point, Brittany, I think part of what people need to recognize is that, like, if a child, if anybody, but especially a child, is sick, every other facet of their life, it should, you know, be clear, is detrimentally affected. We can't begin to address issues of education. We can't begin to address issues of food insecurity. We can't begin to address issues around, you know, potential future employment. If children are sick, like, that exacerbates every other part of a young person's life. And I think that sometimes we get lost in, like, uninsured, insured, what, you know, and we lose sight of the bigger picture of, like, if a person is sick and doesn't have the funds to mitigate that illness, that affects not only that child, but everybody in that family, and detrimentally impacts the economic conditions of those families who are being impacted. So while we know that CHIP covers children in every state across the country, what I don't know that everybody knows is that 18 states across the country use CHIP funding to also cover pregnant women. And so each year, approximately 370,000 pregnant women receive care through CHIP. And these are women who don't qualify for Medicaid, but are still too poor to afford or can't necessarily afford to purchase their own health insurance. And so it kind of covers the people in that gap. And with almost 400,000 pregnant women receiving prenatal care through CHIP, this again, like neonatal care, every study that has been done around the care that a young person gets before they are even born is clear that it impacts every facet of their life trajectory moving forward, right? Again, so this is not only about the safety of the fetus. This is not only about the safety of the mother. This impacts the trajectory of both a mother and child for the rest of their lives if they are unable to get the treatment that they need during those 9 to 10 months. And so that, you know, I didn't necessarily know that until recently, and I just wanted to bring that up because I thought that was an important point.
It's like about 2 million kids are CHIP. What's also interesting about CHIP is CHIP covers about 90% of the cost. So there are a couple states that have said that if CHIP runs out, they will be able to assume the cost. I think Louisiana is actually one of those states that they will pick up the full cost of CHIP in the interim. But very few states can do that because it's 90% of the cost. So it's a huge, huge impact to kids. It's also a reminder that the Republicans are willing to play games with people's lives. And we've gotten this over and over, so this isn't new. But it is important to just note every time. It's like, there's no win in this. This doesn't help people's families. Everybody's constituents are impacted. And still, it's like, this is something people are negotiating about. And you're like, how, Sway? How does that happen? So hopefully CHIP's funding gets renewed before it actually goes away on January the 19th.
And for me, this is another example that exposes the hypocrisy in the Republican Party and how the arguments that they often use to attempt to explain their actions never comport with the facts or rarely comport with the facts. So in this case, you know, there are a whole bunch of Republicans who for so long have been saying we shouldn't spend more money, the government, federal government shouldn't spend money because there's a lot of debt, the debt and the deficit are really bad, and so we need to be fiscal conservatives. And, you know, here you have a bill, you know, to reauthorize this program would actually save the government money. And like there's, as DeRay said, there's no downside to this. Like, this is supporting among the most vulnerable population in the country, like children and pregnant mothers. And yet, and still, even despite all of that, they still have not reauthorized this program. And so I think, you know, ultimately, we've seen with the tax bill how quickly they moved and sacrificed all of the things they said they cared about in order to give the rich more money that they didn't need. And here you have the exact opposite, where it really didn't require any sacrifice at all from them. There was no political downside. There was no economic downside. It was just the right thing to do for people who needed it most. And they can't bring themselves even to do that. And so, you know, it's a huge failure by Republicans, the Republican Party in general, by, you know, our elected leadership. And hopefully we can replace all of those legislators who have dragged their feet on this and hold them accountable in November.
So my news is about the Baltimore City Police Department. There are two things. One, the first is recently, 7 police officers in the Baltimore City Police Department were indicted for racketeering. They were members of an elite gun task force who got indicted for conspiracies that accused them of robbing people, extorting drug dealers for their drugs, filing false reports, and claiming fraudulent overtime. It's like a whole unit of them. And the 7 officers made about $400,000 in overtime pay between July 1st, 2015 and June 20th, 2016, with one officer doubling his $85,000 salary. Now, this is one of the biggest indictments of a section of police in the city of Baltimore. That happened a couple months ago. But what just happened in January 2018 is there was a bail bondsman who pled guilty to helping some of those officers resell drugs. So this bail bondsman, he would help one of the officers with stolen cocaine, heroin, and marijuana. and he would then help them sell them back onto the streets, and they would split the profits. So there's like accounts of a woman saying that she like bought them from his house, and like there was a whole operation, and this is slowly uncovering itself. But when we say that the system of policing is broken at the root, this is what we're talking about. I said, what does it mean with the people who are ostensibly supposed to enforce the rules, keep everybody straight and narrow, are actually inflicting terror on people's lives? Not only are they killing people and harming people using force, which we talk about a lot because it's happening a lot. But this is stuff that we actually don't know until something big happens, or we don't have documented evidence of. People in communities have known this for a long time, but literally like almost entire section of the Baltimore City Police Department, the eighth largest police department in the country, officers are indicted for terrorizing people's communities. And I just wanted to bring that up because so often people say we're like attacking the police and da da da. It's like, no, the police are literally, they're like stealing drugs from drug dealers and reselling it. That is, nothing about that is right. And we should talk about what happens when an institution allows that to flourish.
And I think this builds on, there's a whole body of evidence showing that over-policing, mass incarceration actually contribute to increasing crime and making communities less safe. And this is sort of the other piece of that, which is not only the policing strategy and tactics making communities less safe and terrorizing communities, but the actual police officers literally engaging in criminal activity that is, you know, robbing people, home invasions, burglaries, stealing from folks. I mean, this is about as direct as it gets. And so when we hear, you know, these conversations about, you know, policing and police reform, really opposing further investment in the police, you know, one of the only things that we hear from a lot of elected officials whenever there are issues of crime and people feeling unsafe is, you know, we need more police on the streets. And this is exactly why that those perceptions need to be interrogated, because not only is that strategy not an effective strategy when you look at the research, but then you get situations like this where the police are literally part of the problem. And it does not make sense, therefore, to continue to invest in scaling and expanding that issue until these things are being addressed.
You know, I think, Sam, that is the hard part for people to understand as to why we should not continue to invest in something that is clearly broken, because there is an assumption that more money being funneled into police departments is always the right choice, that we always will need more officers on the street, when actually when you walk around a lot of our communities, people will say they will feel less safe if that is the case. And I think it's just hard for people to connect the dots there, and they want to treat these like isolated incidents instead of recognizing the corruption that exists in an entire system and looking carefully at what that entire system is rooted in. I'm not going to continue to invest lots of funds in something that's broken. I'm going to invest time. I'm going to invest talent. I'm going to invest intellect. I'm going to shift the way that things are done if we continue to use that system at all. But I'm certainly not going to continue to invest funds and capital that could be used elsewhere, especially in a city like Baltimore, where there are lots of places where those funds could be used in things that we know are broken and in things that we know are continuously corrupt.
Yeah, and I think this is important, and it kind of speaks to what we were talking about last week with regard to the Heather McDonald article that was published in the National Review. And it's this idea that should, in this context, you know, Heather McDonald might say that by bringing this up, we are creating an environment that is hostile to police. We are reflecting anti-police sentiment. We are contributing to the what will inevitably be the an exacerbation of the Ferguson effect, where police are incapable of doing their job. But again, like, this is not an isolated incident. This is reflective of like a larger culture and a larger phenomenon that is taking place in municipalities and cities across this country. And the idea that we should not speak to that, and the idea that we should not challenge that, and the idea that that would not then inform the way that people think about institutions of police, that they are told by many people like Heather McDonald that they are supposed to invest their blind trust into, is absurd. And I think we have seen case after case in which police officers fail to uphold the duty that they swear an oath to, and are in fact doing the opposite, right? That they are contributing direct harm to the people whose taxes pay their salaries. And we have to name it, and we have to say it. And And we will continue to say it until we reach a point where these institutions and the people in these institutions are held accountable for the things that they are doing and not seen as these institutions that are unable to receive the critique that we are rightfully and justifiably lobbing their way.
That's the news.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
And now, my conversation with Congressman Crowley, the chair of the Democratic Congress in the House. Well, Congressman Crowley, thanks so much for joining us today on Pod Save the People.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you all.
What committee are you on?
I'm on the Ways and Means Committee. The Ways and Means Committee is in charge of taxation. They develop the ways and the means to pay for the budget of the United States and for what we budget for, what we appropriate. It's in charge of trade, of tariffs. It has a big say in terms of Medicare and Social Security. Those are the issues that primarily come through the committee. And I'm also the chair of the Democratic Caucus.
Now, you're a New Yorker. Were you born and raised in New York?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Queens, in Elmhurst, in St. John's Hospital on Queens Boulevard. It's no longer there, but I've been a lifelong resident of Queens County and of New York City.
And why Congress? Like, what was your pathway to being a congressman?
You know, I don't know if I ever actually woke up one morning and said, I'm going to be a congressman. It wasn't like that. But I was always very politically aware. I came from a very politically active family. My uncle, Walter Crowley, was a civic activist and was involved in local Democratic politics and had ran for office a number of times, almost successfully in the 60s and didn't quite win. But came close, and then same thing in the 70s. And in 1984, he ran for the congressional seat I hold today when Jerry Ferraro ran for vice president. And I was a young man at the time. I was 22, and I was even more engaged than ever at that point. I had been the president of my high school class at Powell Memorial High School on the west side of Manhattan, and I'd been involved in politics at Queens College, my alma mater, in my college days, but I'd ran for president then, and that was my first loss in running for office. But I learned a lot, but I was really intrigued when Jerry Farrar ran for vice president with Walter Mondale, and my uncle was in this race, and we were all in. But I had been involved in politics prior to that. The real first campaign I was engaged in was in 1977 when Mario Cuomo was running for mayor of New York City, and my uncle was behind him, and I was 100. I was square behind him as well. Later, interned for him, and then when I was in the state assembly, he was governor. I was there, so he's one of my heroes in life.
I don't even know where to begin with like what is happening in Congress. It's from an outsider. It seems like it is a nightmare. It feels like a nightmare in the public. Mm. I'd love to know, what is it like to be in Congress right now with so much happening, trying to push back against an agenda from the White House and from the congressional leadership that it just isn't in the best interest of the people you represent or so many people around the country? What's it like?
You know, I've had some you know, a number of experiences in the House throughout my years of service, but it's never been quite like it is today. It's exhausting in many respects. You know, you wake up every morning and there's tweets you have to respond to, even just mentally respond to in your own brain. But it has, you know, real life consequences. You know, when the president tweets out that he thinks that people should have work requirements before they'd be eligible for Medicaid. You know, I question myself, does the president work enough to be eligible for the benefits that he receives at this point? You know, but it's just mind-boggling in terms of what we're grappling with. And at the same time, you know, I've been inspired to be in government and to want to help advance people and help advance the country. And here I see just on a daily basis something that's being taken away, or their attempt to whether it's the Dreamers and deport them, or it's, you know, this tax bill that is a big giveaway to the wealthiest corporations in the history of the world and the wealthiest in this country, the greatest country on earth, giving so much to the who least need it at the expense of future generations. It's exhausting, to say the least.
You started talking about the Medicaid work requirement. Can you just sum that up for people that don't know what you were talking about, that don't know the issue deeply and sort of where it's at?
Well, the president is saying that he's in favor of seeing additional work requirements for people to be eligible for Medicaid. And, you know, I think it's quite ludicrous in the sense that the notion or idea behind Medicaid is to ensure that the least amongst us, those who have the least, have a modicum of exposure to healthcare, that a healthier population is something that we all should be in favor of. A healthier workforce, quite frankly, really relies upon Medicaid. So, again, I think it's just another attempt by this president to offer red meat to his base that thinks that there are too many people who are freeloading, or that that somehow that people want to be on Medicaid, that's the, you know, a life dream of people, and it's not. I mean, people do want a better way of life for themselves. They want to have those opportunities, but we're talking about children. We're talking about poor children and poor individuals in this country, and those are the ones who will be hurt by this. And I just think that this president fails to see this. You know, we both grew up in Queens, New York, but I grew up on the other side of the tracks, or in this case, as I like to say, the other side of the Long Island Expressway. And I just don't think he has a real sense of what life potentially really is for someone who lives in public housing or someone who's living on the margins. And it's easy for him to tweet these things out and not really fully understand the full consequences of what this means to an individual's life.
Yeah, I know you've also been really vocal around immigrant rights. And can you talk about what's going on with temporary protected status and what's at stake, or what can Congress do? What can we do to press Congress or our local officials?
Well, a lot of this is at the discretion of the executive and the president at this point. Temporary protective status was issued to a number of countries. Nepal, probably most recently, I think it was in 2015 after their earthquake. But we've had Nicaragua, we've had El Salvador, we've had Haiti. A number of countries that have had natural disasters, where we give this temporary status so that we give some relief to those countries as well, let them get back on their feet. In the case of El Salvador, which was recently announced that the White House would suspend the TPS, they're giving these individuals who have been living here for quite some time, some for over 20 or 25 years, 18 months to gather all their things and leave the country. And it is for many of these individuals, their children are American citizens. They've been ensconced here for, as I said, almost a quarter of a century. They own homes, they're own businesses. And I think it's really without regard as to what's going to happen to these individuals. Almost a quarter of a million El Salvadorians here in the United States that would be because of this decision, forced to leave the country in 18 months. What I hope can happen here is that before that, we'll bring balance back to Washington, that we'll see a change in government here in the House of Representatives, that we'll be in a position to leverage and to help keep these folks here in the United States.
Is there anything we can do about it, or do we just wait until maybe we win back the House or the Senate and then maybe it can slow down, or are we just sort of screwed in this moment?
I do think that to some degree, what we have here is a real crisis for these individuals because I think the more your listeners understand what they're facing, aside from the American citizen aspect of the children of those who have protective status, going back to El Salvador right now, where we know there's a tremendous gang violence, and it's a very violent country in many respects, that we're putting people who are in a stable environment and sending them back to a less than stable environment. So I think more people understand what's happening in these individual countries will understand why it's important for them not to be forcibly sent back to their country of origin at this point in time. And quite frankly, I think, when you're here for 20 or 25 years, to just ask people to uplift and go back is not a very realistic thing to do. They're contributing to our society. They're contributing to our economy. They are not a security risk. They have been fully vetted and gone through background checks. They may not be eligible for citizenship, but I do think that they ought to be able to stay here. But what your listeners need to know is that they need to be informed and understand why it is important that they stay here. And that I do believe that ultimately we have 18 months, and that's a good bit of time. That means we'll have an election between now and then. And my hope is that if we are able to restore some balance here in Washington, that we can address that issue.
How does DACA play into this? Does DACA play into this at all, or is DACA covered under something else?
DACA is a separate issue. DACA are the dreamers, or those individuals who were brought to the United States by their parents undocumented, and when they were children. And under an executive order that was signed by then President Obama, they were given status to register with the federal government to be issued work papers, be able to attend school, and contribute to society. President Trump suspended that in September of last year, and it's set to expire in March of this year, unless Congress acts legislatively to turn that around. And what's happening right now, there are negotiations in the House of Representatives, in the Senate, and between the House, Senate, and the White House on this issue right now. I think it's been cluttered by the inclusion by the White House and by my Republican colleagues, more conservative colleagues, with issues that really pertain to a broader comprehensive immigration reform bill and are not relevant, in my opinion, to the issue of the Dreamers or DACA recipients. And that would include, I think, the president's wall. These individuals, much like the TPS individuals, they are not a threat to the security of the United States. They are Americans in every way but in paper. They love this country. They're contributing mightily towards it, and they want to be even more contributory towards our country. And I think for that reason, we should really pass a clean DREAM Act or a DACA bill.
Is that likely? Or will do you think that the Dems will have to give up something substantial to get DACA passed, or do you think it'll happen at the last minute?
Well, I do think that, that remains to be seen, just what, if any machinations behind the scene will be worked to forge some kind of a bill. But I have serious concerns about mingling with the issue of the Dreamers or DACA recipients, the issue of diversity visas, or family reunification. And I think that's what the White House and my Republican colleagues, in particular Kevin McCarthy, have raised most recently. I don't think they're relevant to this issue at all of the DACA recipients, nor, quite frankly, do I think a wall is relevant to this. As I said, they are not a security threat. They are here. They're contributing to this country. And I think that the expense of a wall in of itself is one of the most biggest boondoggles that we could hoist upon the American people. As I've said repeatedly, you cannot live in this wall. You cannot drive on this wall. It is a waste of infrastructure, and it's a negative message to our southern neighbors. It's environmentally unsound and ought not to take place. So I would not support a dream bill that would include a wall, and I have very strong reservations about including those other issues in negotiating on the issue of the Dreamers.
Now, what about the privatization of Social Security? I know that that's been an issue that's come up in the past year or so. Mm-hmm. First, can you help people understand what the issue is? Because I would say a lot of people like hear the phrase but don't really know. What's your position on it?
Well, I'm vehemently opposed to the privatization of Social Security. The Republicans attempted to do that a number of years ago, and they were fought back by Democrats. And in fact, it was one of the reasons why they lost control of the House of Representatives back in 2010. We vehemently opposed the privatization. What that would do, it would allow for investment in the stock markets for portions of one Social Security check. And I just don't think, look, the markets are performing well right now. They have been, quite frankly, not just this year, but they have consistently since the day that Barack Obama took office, they've improved tremendously. And there is a role for the markets to play. And I'm not here to say that people ought not to invest and have a diversified portfolio. But to take something that is supposed to be a given, a sure thing, that when everything else fails, that their Social Security will be there. I just don't think we should have our retirees looking every day at the paper to see how their Social Security is doing in relation to the stock markets. So I do think what you have here, DeRay, in the passage of this this tax bill, this tax scam, as we call it, is really you have a draining of the resources of the United States. What the Republicans did with this bill is they refinanced the House of the United States, and they took almost $2 trillion out of the House, and they, instead of putting it into their kids' college funds or into the infrastructure of the House by putting a new roof on it, they gave that money to the wealthiest corporations in the history of the world and to the wealthiest in this country. That's what happened. And what they're doing is they're borrowing against the future of America. And what I really believe, Dre, what they really want to do is to use this as the predicate to now go after the entitlements, as they call them, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and make drastic cuts to them in order to lower the deficit and to lower the debt of the nation. And I think it's just a real incredible bait and switch that's gone on here.
You know, I was talking to somebody recently about food stamps. That food stamps might be under siege as as they look to go after entitlements and other welfare programs. So we'll stay tuned to see what the farm bill.
That's absolutely right. And that's why it's so critical that we have parity in terms of what we spend on defense and what we spend on domestic spending as well. And food stamps and other programs like that are at risk right now.
Now, what about CHIP? Is CHIP going to get, is health insurance for kids going to get put back in the next whatever, or
yes,
is that actually going to go away?
No, I think it actually is going, we're going to pass that. I think that I feel more confidently about that than before. The reality is it's sad to say that when they took away the mandate for the Affordable Care Act in their tax bill, it had an impact on the cost of CHIP and actually reduced it from $8 billion to $800 million and therefore a much more manageable piece that can be rectified fairly easily now. I suspect that we will pass CHIP in the very, very near future.
Is it too early to talk about 2020 and who's going to run for president?
No, I don't. Look, I think it's, if I said it was too early, it still wouldn't be too early for the people who are interested in running. So it's, I do think we have 2018 first that we want to get behind and ensure that, I, as I said before, bring balance back to Washington. I think that's what's sorely missing here. I think, I may not like the fact that folks voted for Donald Trump. I think that he sold them a pig and a poke, but you know, I have to respect their right to do that, and not, you know, to some degree, not be as questioning of it at this point. But I do think 2020 is not too far from 2018, and I think that's the setup. And you know, we're hearing of Joe Biden going around the country. We hear of Oprah Winfrey, and that's caused quite a stir. You know, that she may be potentially interested in running. We know that there are, you know, which I think is, DeRay, which I think is very interesting, is that a number of House members, you know, you have like Tim Ryan from Ohio, you know, someone who wouldn't necessarily get exposure is being talked about as a potential presidential nominee. Governor Cuomo, and there are quite a few New Yorkers. I think Bill de Blasio and Kirsten Gillibrand, and I've even heard Mike Bloomberg might be looking at this as a Democrat as well. I just think there's a wealth of Democrats out there that are looking at this, both the governors and the House and the Senate, but even business people. We know of Mr. Iger of Disney, Mr. Schultz, and as I mentioned before, Oprah.
Really?
Winfrey.
The Disney guy?
Yeah, I've heard his name bantered about a bit, you know. So I think if they figure if Donald Trump can do it, why can't they? You know, maybe they're right. So,
do you have anybody? Do you have a short list of people that you think we should be paying attention to?
You know, not yet. My focus really is here on winning back the House and looking at the I think our leverage and our opportunities to win House seats in New York, in California, especially in light of this this tax bill and the attack on SALT, state and local tax deductibility. What's that doing to our local governments and to our state like New York? So I think there are great opportunities in New York, in California, Pennsylvania, even Florida. And we see the recent announcement redistricting, the courts throwing out the redistricting in North Carolina, and that effect. What's going to happen in Pennsylvania if they actually redistrict? Can that give some advantage back to Democrats? And I feel, you know, we need 24 seats to win back the House of Representatives. We've identified 23 that Hillary Clinton won, of which 21 Barack Obama also won that are held by Republicans today. And that's fertile ground for us. We have to expand that field, I think, way beyond 45 seats to be really competitive. But I feel as though with the president's numbers so low, with the general malaise I think the country feels in terms of the direction of the country, that it's an opportunity for us. But we need to not only be against this president, what he stands for, which we are, but we need to be for something as well. And I think that's what is going to help really push the public towards the Democrats in this upcoming election.
Do you think that the Mueller investigation is going to go anywhere, or is this just, or we got to wait it out? Or like, what's your, well, I consider you much more of an insider than us.
I think the Mueller investigation's already gone somewhere. It has two convictions, and you have the former national security advisor who's likely going to jail. And I think that has already produced some issues here. What I've said and repeatedly, I know people talk about the need to impeach the president and all these things. I think we need to let the Mueller investigation continue. He's doing his job, and it's a solemn job. It's not something just for politics. It's about our country. It's about our nation, and it needs to be done properly. And let the facts lead where they may. And that includes if the president is exonerated in terms of collusion or if his administration or his campaign is, well, we have to accept that as well. I think what's most important is we need to, as Democrats, set out an agenda of positive growth for our nation, job growth for our constituencies. And that's how we're going to be successful. It's about the better deal. It's about better jobs, better wages, and a better future for our nation. And as the chair of the caucus, that's one of my roles, to help ensure that we stay as unified as possible, working with Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer and Jim Clyburn, and the vice chair of the Democratic caucus is Linda Sanchez from California, working together to ensure that unity as best we can to provide the best leverage we can to promote the issues that we feel are reflective of the Democratic caucus and reflective of our country as well.
Now, there are a lot of people in this moment who have lost hope, who feel like the world is sort of crumbling around them. They protested, they marched, they've been to every panel they can go to, and they still feel like nothing's changing. What do you say to those people?
I say to them, never bet against America. I think America and Americans, generally speaking, are inherently a good, decent, honorable people. We stray a little bit, and I think that was represented in terms of this election. But we'll come back, and I think the American people are about goodness.
And where can people go to follow you to stay up on what you're doing?
Well, they can get me on Twitter at Rep Joe Crowley. That's probably the easiest way, at Rep Joe Crowley.
Rep Joe Crowley. Cool. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Can't wait to have you back again to keep us updated. We'll follow what you're doing what the House is doing as we try and survive the next couple of years.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you. Great being with you.
Well, that's it. Thanks for listening to this episode of Pod Save the People. Make sure that you share it with a friend. And also make sure that you buy tickets to the first live show of Pod Save the People ever. It's happening in D.C. February 18th. Do it now.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Chumba. Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus terms and conditions apply.